Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of the world's best resource for hockey strength and conditioning information. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of SCAF and ProHockeyStrength.com. In episode 101 and episode 3 of our SCAF alumni series, Mike Vitenza and I are joined by Mark Fitzgerald. If you don't know Mark, he currently runs his private training facility called Elite Training Systems in Ontario, and he's also the head of performance and combine development with Under Armour. Previously, he was the head strength and conditioning coach of the Anaheim Ducks from 2015 to 2019, and the head strength coach of the Toronto Marlies in the AHL from 2008 to 2014. Mark is one of the younger strength coaches who I know I followed for years, and so I was really excited to sit down and talk to him and hear about some of his experiences from working in the private sector to the NHL to the AHL. So this was a really fun episode. To find Mark and, of course, everything discussed, show notes will all be at prohockeystrength.com. And without further ado, here is Mike Vitenza and Mark Fitzgerald. Welcome to episode number 101 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Today, I'm again with Mr. Mike Vitenza along with Mark Fitzgerald. Mark, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming.
101. Thanks, Potsy. Thanks for putting me in such a high ranking. Thanks for thinking of me first, I guess, or 101st.
Is this your first time? Is this your first time on the show, Mark?
Yeah, I think so.
Really? That sounds shocking to me.
I know, right?
Well, in any case, welcome to the show. The first thing I want to ask you is, you started before working in the NHL. You started in the AHL with the Toronto Marlies in, I think, 2008, if I'm reading correctly. What was that experience like working in the AHL, and how does it compare to being in an NHL environment?
I got asked this question a few times, and I think I was just looking back at some answers that I just popped up on my timeline or whatever in one of those social channels. And, you know, I really enjoyed the AHL because it's just a different mindset with a lot of the players. You know, it's a hungry mindset. And that's not to say that, you know, guys in the NHL aren't hungry and they don't want to, you know, be the best and all that kind of stuff, but it's just different. You know, it's the ultimate carrot is the NHL for those guys. And, you know, I think the openness or the willingness to do the little things, the willingness to do, extra is a lot higher at the AHL level. And I think working for Toronto was, you know, first class organization. And when I went in there, it was just myself that I looked up the Marlies, and then I had opportunities to go up and down with the Leafs as well, which is cool because it was just me and another guy, Anthony Belza, who Potsy, you might know. And he was unbelievable to me, just kind of letting me, you know, we shared the same building, even though we had our own practice rink and gym and whatever in the Leafs. We just walked across the hallway and they were there. So I had a lot of opportunity to kind of see both sides of it. So I think it gave me a pretty, you know, unique perspective on the path, you know, to get there, where, and you saw that, you know, high draft pick, low draft pick, college signing, you know, maybe someone who shouldn't be there, whatever. I saw them all, and nobody's path is overly linear. You know, even those high picks, you know, I think it was just a matter of, you know, trying to help each individual navigate their own path and, you know, put them in a position to succeed. And I think that was kind of the cool part to it, is that, you know, you probably have more impact as an AHL strength coach on that person's career, you know, initially, than you do as, you know, someone coming to me and with the Ducks or the Leafs and being kind of, you know, 5 years in, and they already have their kind of routines and their habits and what have you. And I think if you do it well, you can really build relationships, and you can really set somebody up for success. And that could be just how they warm up. That could be just nutrition, you know, implementation. That could be habits, whatever. I think you have a really cool opportunity at that level to really be a teacher, be a leader, you know, whatever you want to call it. And I really, really enjoyed that part. And it was, you know, we got to train, you know, and Potsy will tell you, like, it's NHL, it's just like a constant warm-up. You know, like you never get to do a ton of work, depending on the, you know, if you're dealing with, you know, everyday players that aren't injured necessarily, you know, you don't get to go down the rabbit hole too much. Whereas the AHL, like, hey, we played on, you know, Saturday, Sunday, we don't play again until Thursday. Like we can lift, we, you know, we can do stuff. We can do stuff other than, you know, long dynamic warmups, you know? So it's, I think it's kind of a cool place to be in your career. And it's cool to experience that level just because, again, I think it gives you a different perspective when you, if you do move up, you know, and, or move on to a different, to the NHL or what have you, I think, again, just a different perspective.
Yeah. The habits are key, right? Like developing and creating those habits for kids. So they get, when they do get called up and they perform, or, you know, they're exposed to the head strength coach of the NHL, and they see the coaches see what their habits and actions are. It's key. You can, it's yeah. So make some great impactful things, you know.
How did you, I was like getting a, you know, a text from Bells, you know, we did send a guy up and he would just say, you know, man, you know, X, Y, this guy looks great. Or, you know, hey, wow, he's ready to go. Or like, he would comment on that. He was really good about that. And, you know, as a younger AHL coach, it's like, you like hearing that, you know, that kind of puffs your chest out a little bit, and it kind of reinforces like, hey, okay, I am on the right path. And he helped me a ton, and just sharing information. And, you know, Toronto's an interesting place to work just because, you know, I think one of our coaches, Dallas Eakins, he counted the steps from our practice rink to the Leafs practice rink. And I forget what it was, you know, 362 steps to the NHL. All you got to do is, you know, and that was such like, that was our mindset, you know? So it was a cool kind of, everybody kind of had the same, you know, and everybody knew that, hey, you're here, but you can be here, you know? So that was, I thought that was neat.
As a coach, how did you deal with, you know, you get, kid gets called up and it's exciting, right? Like it's so exciting to see them and their energy that they get called up and they made it. Then they play one game and then they get sent back down, you know, or they play however many games and get sent back down. So it's almost like you get this unbelievable dream promotion and then you get this demotion, you know? So as a coach, how did you keep guys on track when they came down? You know, it's something that I learned right away and always had to deal with it, but also teach my minor league strength coach how to deal with it, because they're getting the brunt of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's similar to, you know, I had that same kind of conversation with my 9-year-old son this morning because he had hockey, and, you know, it came out and, you know, a couple quick questions. Hey, how was it? And he's a kind of an emotional kid. And he's like, oh, just not my, you know, bad practice. It was a bad practice, you know, and he's hard on himself, which is, you know, good and bad, or positive and negative. And I said, well, buddy, I said, you know, you can't, you know, not too high, not too low. That's something I've said to all my kids. And I ended up saying it, I think it came from interactions with athletes who exactly went through what you just said, you know, like you get the high of getting called up and, you know, only to realize that you're going to ride a plane, you're going to go there and work out, you're going to go for the morning skate, and then you're going to sit in the press box and eat popcorn. And that's okay. You know, the fact that you got called up, the fact that you, you know, are on that radar is a good thing, you know, and, you know, not too high, not too low. If you get called up for a game and sent right back down, hey, great. They know who you are. You know, we had guys that went through the whole year and never got a call, you know, and that was tougher to keep those guys, like, you know, eyes on the prize type thing, as opposed to the guys who were getting up and down. I think that's kind of a positive thing, to be honest. But yeah, I think it's just, you know, trying to navigate them through that rhythm of the ups and downs, you know, like not too high, not too low, you know, don't get down too deep where you don't think it's going to happen, because that's going to, you know, inhibit your performance down here. Just enjoy where you are, you know, like work hard. Don't, you know, put yourself in a position where they have to call you up, you know, because that's ultimately going to be, you know, don't always be ready too, you know, all you can, every cliche you can imagine to throw in there, but they're true, you know, and it's the guys that did that, the guys that didn't, you know, ride the roller coaster, you know, with two highs and two lows, it's even keel, their performance stayed consistent, or, you know, rose with the training, whatever. Those are the guys that had the longer term success, you know. And hey, if you're playing AHL hockey in Toronto and you're making $250,000 a year, and you live, you know what I mean? Like you're living in the city, like it's not a bad gig either, you know? And I think that's, and $250,000 might be a bit high, but even still, like, you're making really good money as a 22-year-old. Like, you should enjoy that, you know, or you should at least try to. So that was always my advice, is just, you know, ride the wave a little bit and don't get too mired in, you know, one phone call or a lack of a phone call, for a better word.
This could be for both of you. What about on the NHL side? Mark, after being with the Marlies for several years, you moved on to the Anaheim Ducks. Were you there for four seasons from 2015 to 2019? Correct. Please fact check anything.
Yep.
What was it like on the other side when a player comes up and he's in the press box and it's your job now? Oh, he has days off. I need to train him. Or like, what's that being on the NHL and on the NHL side of it?
You know what? I think that conversation's a little easier. And in that regard, it's like, hey, you're a pro. You know, you come up and you handle this like a pro, and you come up and do whatever the hell you need to do. Like, that's the way that I looked at it. You know, it's, you're part of this team. You're part of this unit, just like I am. We have different roles. If your role tonight is to come up here and, you know, do the warm up and then get a lift in, then that's your role. And, you know, you're going to be back in a car and back in San Diego by tomorrow morning or tonight, then that's what it is. You know, like, that's the reality of it. Be a pro. Come in, we'll work hard, and that'll be that, you know. And the guys that just understood that are the guys that you saw a lot. You know, those are the guys that are consistently called up because they know that the attitude and the presence that they bring to the room is a positive one. They're not going in and bringing guys down and being sulky and, you know, this and that with, you know, the ups and downs of what it can be. They're just coming up, they're working, they're grateful to be there. And those are the guys, like, that's always been my attitude. If I had a guy that was sulky, like, what are you doing? You know, like, this is a job, be a pro, you know. And that's, it's hard. I know it's hard, but, you know, you have an opportunity here. Have the best, you know, morning skate of your life. You know, don't miss a pass. Don't give any bad passes. Like, I think when those guys had that type of focus, it was, you know, they made the most of it. And again, another cliche, but they're true. They're cliches for a reason, you know? And I think that's, seeing the value in those opportunities, whether you see them as, you know, morning skates and just being with the team, like, sometimes that's all you need. As you know, Potts, like, that could be like a, hey, let's call that guy up again. You know, like, I've been asked that before. Hey, do you know this guy? Yeah, he's awesome, good worker, guys love him. Okay, now whether or not that made the final decision, who knows, but hey, it may have contributed to it, you know. So if I had a guy come up who was a jackass and it didn't want to work and, you know, did dumb stuff, had his phone in the gym, whatever, I'm definitely not going to say that about him, you know? So everybody's, if you're on a good club, if you're on a staff that gets it, everybody wants to win, right? So if you come into the room and you start, you know, sucking the energy out of the room, people notice, you know? And I think that's, it goes back to being a pro. Be a pro, come ready to work, do what you need to do. And that's that. And you can only you know, whatever opportunity they give you, you have to make the most of it. And that's that.
Yeah. And those, especially being humble, like Mark says, like, that's key. Number one, I know I've communicated that to our younger players who've got called up over the years I've been here, but also they have an opportunity to have a front row seat to, you know, in Mark's case, you know, Ryan Getzlaf. In our case, it was Joe Thornton, Patty Marleau, Joe Pavelski, and Brent Burns, like our highest and guys who've achieved a lot, but also have worked, you know, work at it every day. It's like, just, it's right in front of you. All you have to do is just, you know, go home and write some notes and in a journal. And like, you have a front row seat to some of the best guys in the game, you know, so learn from that. You know, they're here for a reason, you know.
And make sure you make an impression, you know, like, I think that's not that you have to do it every time, I think, but, you know, if those, some of those names that you mentioned, if they don't know who you are, well, find a way to, you know, get your name in the mix. Even if it's something as little as, like, you know, your pregame warm up or your, you know, whatever, anything. And it doesn't mean ass kissing or anything like that. It's just, you know, try to make an impression and make it one. And that's, you know, an honest one, and not, you know, don't be phony either, because, you know, some of those guys are some of the best at picking apart people that are full of shit. And that's, you don't want to get into that, you know, and Getzlaf is definitely one of those guys.
Yeah. And Joe was actually a guy who he wanted to know if they could play, like, what they,
right.
You know, you think a lot of the times it was like, they're just like, all right, who's this guy coming in? And the, you know, just who is he? And then the guys who are kind of a first and second year pro, they're like, oh shit, this guy's here probably to take my job, you know? So there's a little bit of that, but Joe always wanted to know, like, can he play? You know, Joe wanted the best guys or people who were ready to go out there with him. I thought that was pretty cool, because he invested conversations and time and showing him his routines and showing him how he thought, how to do stuff, you know. Both Thornton and Pavelski, I should say, you know, they were great. So
yeah, makes sense.
Another really interesting aspect of your career path, Mark, to me, is you simultaneously worked as an NHL strength coach while also running your own facility in Ontario. I'm just curious, maybe how you balance that, or maybe how you struggled to balance that of being an entrepreneur, a business owner, while also working for an NHL club.
Yeah, well, I don't think I've ever balanced it. Yeah, balancing does not exist. I hate that word. I obviously don't hate it, but you know, that definitely doesn't exist in my world. I don't think in anybody who's, you know, has this similar experience. I'm very fortunate to have an amazing staff of people that work with me with ETS, and you know, we have three gyms now in Ontario, and you know, it's, when I first left, I remember having the conversation with my staff, just because the Anaheim thing wasn't a planned thing. You know, I left Toronto, I resigned because it's just my, you know, my family is growing. We just had our twins, boy, girl twins, and we had another son already, and the gym was doing well. And I didn't, you know, I started to not like driving into Toronto every day. And it was just, it was starting to not make sense, you know? And, when I made the decision to leave, and I thought I was, you know, just going to leave pro hockey, you know, and then the Ducks thing came up, and it was like, huh, well, young family, California, like, it's not the end of, it's not the worst place to live. So let's go have an adventure type thing. And, I sat down with my staff about 30 days before I left, because I signed the contract about July 25th. And I had literally 30 days to kind of sell our house, pack up and go. And, I remember telling my staff, I just said, hey, look, I'm leaving, and I'm going to find out a couple things. Number one, if I actually have a business, because I'm going to remove myself from it. And I'm going to figure out pretty fast if we have an actual system that churns and makes money. And number two, I'm going to find out if that system that I've put in place and the people that I've hired and the partnerships that we have and all this stuff is actually going to work, you know, because I'm going to take out the cog that, not that I was the be all and end all, but it was my gym and it was my concept and whatever. Right. So, I remember looking at their faces too. I'll never forget it, because they were all just like, holy shit. Like, what, you know, there was a lot of unknown, and I didn't know either. Right. So I also said too, which I don't know if it was the best thing to say, because I said, look, this stuff's all mine. You know, I don't owe anybody anything. I don't, you know, if something goes wrong, I'll pack up all this equipment, I'll put it in storage. And when I come home in the summers, I'll open it back up. I said, I don't, you know, I have a job, I make money, I don't need it. So like, either, and I was trying to be motivational, but it was more, I'm sure it was stress induced as well. But I was saying, like, look, either you guys take it and run with it, or it's just going to go away. And I don't want that, but I also have to go and do a very difficult job and take care of my family and be away from all our support networks across, you know, North America. So, you know, I need you to pick up and go, or pick up and run the business. And, you know, we gave everybody distinct kind of roles within that, and some better than others. And it, you know, it worked. And I think it's still working, because I trust and have a great staff that are able to execute, and they care, you know, and they're loyal. And I think those are a couple words, the loyalty one especially, that, you know, I'm so fortunate to have the people that I have. And I think the whole managing thing and, you know, balancing whatever, made a lot of mistakes and still do, but I think I'm better at evaluating those bigger decisions now. And I think I'm also better at communicating with my team as to what that vision is and why we're doing what we're doing, you know. And I think that's, you know, even, you know, currently with the COVID stuff, I said to my staff the other day, I said, you know, my gym's not going anywhere. You know, we're not going to close, we're not going to whatever, because I feel like we have a good team. We've held on to our core people, you know, and we still have a business. We're still generating revenue. Not what it was, but you know, we're surviving, and that also shows me something. I think we're going to come out of this with in a pretty decent position, you know, and I think where a lot of other places are unfortunately going away, or, you know, having to get into these loans and what have you. And we've avoided all that. And that's, you know, that's pretty remarkable, and shows you that the team that I have and the trust is, you know, exponentially beneficial. Sorry, my dog's running around. You know, so I think it just comes back to having a good team of people that I trust, and being able to kind of just leave it, you know, and just say, here's the vision, here's how we do this, and I'm going to try not to micromanage this thing to death, you know. And I think I didn't do a good job of that initially. You know, I was trying to do it all at the start, and then I slowly learned that, hey, if it fails, you know, the person doesn't do the job that I would do, I have to be okay with that. And I have to try to, you know, shape and mentor and coach as best I can. At the same time, while I'm also being mentored, you know, like I'm still learning myself. So I think it was just a big growth curve, and it was just a big learning curve. And, you know, I still don't live in Ontario where my gyms are. And, you know, it's probably better that way, you know, because they're just used to it now. And obviously I'm there a lot more now, but I just come in and, you know, I think I do what I need to do now, which is minimal. And my staff have just kind of like absorbed the rest, which is amazing. So it's, yeah, I wouldn't recommend it if you're starting a gym, but it was an interesting way to find out if we had a business.
As you go now, and it's been, geez, I don't know, I guess in every 5 years, like when you have a philosophical change about what you're going to do in the gym, do you still have that ability to bring that into the fold? And is your philosophy retained, you know, everybody's still doing it the way you set it up when it first started and how you've grown, or do you give them continuity to try different things and all that?
I definitely give them the freedom, especially as a coach. You know, I don't want to be, I guess it's somewhat of a micromanager in terms of like, hey, everybody should do, you know, 5 sets of 5. Like, I'll never do that, because, you know, I said it to my director of performance the other day. I'm like, I love coming into the gym and just seeing what our coaches are doing, you know. And like, yes, there's kind of a holistic, you know, philosophy around, you know, performance and what it means, and kind of, you know, we have some principles up on the wall, but like, I want to leave that open, because like, as you guys know, like our field is constantly changing, evolving. We got guys like Cal Dietz, who's, you know, like the mad scientist, just, you know, building these concepts. And there's so many amazing coaches in our field that, like, I feel like if I was married to one methodology, you know, that we'd be in trouble, you know. I think, and not that we bounce around to chasing fads and stuff like that, that's not what I'm saying. I guess it's just a, you know, our at our holistic level, it's how do we make athletes better, you know. And it comes back for me, it's like, what's the role of a strength coach? Is, well, you make sure your players are available to play, you know, whether that's practice, games, whatever. You make sure those players are available to play at the highest level. And if they're always available to play, they're not missing games, they're not missing opportunities to play, they're healthy, well, bigger, stronger, and faster, more mobile, all those other attributes that we like to talk about. Well, those are a lot easier to accomplish with a healthy athlete, you know? So that's how I've always looked at it. And I think we, you know, with ETS, we do the same. And I love going in there and sitting with our coaches, and, you know, I'll have an athlete in town that I'm there to see, and they say, okay, here's our warm up. I'm like, yeah, jump in. I want to watch. I want to steal, you know, I want to steal stuff. And I have some really amazing coaches, both, you know, less experience, more experience, similar to me, whatever, that just, you know, see it through different lenses, or do this first before this. Okay, great. Why? You know, like, and I think, you know, our staff has also done a fantastic job on the education side, you know, going to conferences, hosting conferences, connecting with chiros, PTs, you know, different people in our industry. And if, I guess, really long-winded answer, if anything, I'm trying to teach my coaches to be open-minded, and to be accepting of other people's ideas, and methodologies, and to have your own filter by which you can say, hey, that's something that I can fit in, or if that's something that doesn't work for me, you know. And Mike Boyle talks about this all the time. It's like, you know, I don't Olympic lift with every one of my guys because some of them are just awful and it's not worth it. It's not worth it to try to make them into something that they're clearly not, you know. And can we get away with a overhead med ball throw and, you know, whatever, you know, the analogies, but it's, you know, I think that philosophy, that the underlying holistic philosophy is, how do we make athletes better? You know, and there's a lot of ways to do it. I'm not an X's and O's guy like that. I steal shit from people and, you know, whatever works for different athletes, you know. And I think having the ability to, you know, build your own filter and build your own, you know, lens by which you see things through is probably the most powerful tool as a coach. And I know a lot of strength coaches who are paycheck to paycheck because they're Poliquin guys and that's all they do. And I'm not shitting on him. He's unbelievable. Or they're Olympic lifting guys and that's all they do. And oh, they don't want to talk about anything other than, you know, Pedersen step ups and, you know, tempo and, you know, and those are important things. But if you're not looking at that, like Bill Knowles is a perfect example of that. Like what he does in the gym is unlike any other gym that I've ever seen. And it's so unorthodox or whatever you want to call it, but really it's not, because it's all about movement and it's about understanding different areas of movement. And that's important because the guys that we see aren't weightlifters. Some of them don't even like being in the gym. So how do you make sure that they do what they need to do? Well, if I'm standing there with a, you know, Olympic lifting and lifting shoes for them, like, no, it's not going to work. And it's going to put them in a box that is not really going to allow them to excel at their sport. And I think that's, I know, super long winded answer now, but
everything, if all you have is a hammer, then everything becomes a nail. I think Mike's said that one before too, which I tell you what, if I didn't meet Bill, that's actually a great example for you, brought. If I didn't meet Bill, I would be lost in a lot of the rehab stuff that I've been able to do. Been what a blessing in this job that you get to be so involved in the rehabilitation or reconditioning process, you know?
Well, the other part too is, like, I remember taking an athlete to Bill because I was just, at the time, I just was stuck. I was stuck, and I took him to Bill because I had met him through another doctor that I do some work with. And, you know, we sat down for like 2 hours and just shop talk, right? And then, well, it was more me just listening and saying, try not to sound dumb. And he said one thing that will stick with me for the rest of my life, probably, or as long as I'm coaching, is that when an athlete gets injured, and we were talking about knee injuries at the time, because I had a guy that just had one, and I wanted to build a really solid plan around it, whatever. He's like, when that injury happens, that the dimmer switch just goes down on that athlete, that dimmer switch in the leg and all the connectivity that goes back into the, you know, the mainframe, whatever you want to call it. And I was just like, man, that really makes sense to me. That really makes sense. It's like, and then he, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, you know, you got to find ways to, you know, push that dimmer back up and get that light back on as soon as you can. You know, you can't let that dimmer sit for too long, because that's, you know, you start talking about re-injury, you start talking about the opposite limb getting injured, you know, like all this, like cascading negative effects of keeping that dimmer down too long. And I was like, man, that is such a good way to look at it. Like, that just totally makes sense with me. And it's like, how do you do that? It's, you know, mini exposures, it's BFR, it's the pool, it's, you know, all of these different little, you know, modalities, and not one is better than the other. It's just knowing when to kind of plug those in and like, what's the goal? Are we putting the dimmer back up today? Or are we making this guy, you know, walk around with crutches and, you know, stim and ice and all that shit? Like, no, we're going to make this guy move in whatever capacity that he can. And then the next day we're going to do a little bit more and we're going to do a little bit more. And like that to me was, he's totally changed the way that I think about even training, you know, and lots of people have, but he's definitely one that, you know, I still bounce stuff off him and just, you know, hey, what do you think of this? He sent me an article not that long ago that I use now all the time, you know, why athletes should avoid the bars. And he's talking about barbells. And it's like, you'd piss a lot of people off if, you know, somebody posted it or talked about it, because it just goes against, you know, gyms are filled with racks and barbells and plates, right? Like, and mine are too, but they've changed a lot. You know, now there's some balance beams in there. Now there's some, you know, just different ways of doing things. And all of a sudden, hey, this guy hasn't missed a game in 3 years. You know, this guy, you know, keeps getting better with age. Why? Well, because we're not trying to crush him every summer. You know, like, it's, hey, this guy's 6'6", 260. Maybe he shouldn't be deadlifting a barbell from the ground. Yeah. Just a thought, you know, like, that body's not really built to do that. What else can we do? Hey, he's still strong. Well, actually, he's stronger. How do we do that? You know, like, it's just super interesting. That's why I love our field. Like, it's just, there's so many different ideas, and some are terrible, to be honest, but very few. I think you can always find something from, you know, some of these people that are innovating and, you know, challenging the status quo to some degree. And that's, I think that's what makes it fun too.
I just want to underscore a few things for our audience that has come up a few times. And in particular, Reg Grant said this in our last episode, that you need to stay open-minded and not be married to one training concept or modality. To quote, I think, Anthony Donskoff, this is in his book, methods are many, but principles are few. Secondly, like Mark said, is question what we assume to be correct. The assumption that barbells are the best. That's what we all thought for years. And it wasn't until someone had the thought to be like, wait a second, is it an experiment, that we found other methods.
Yeah. I mean, and Reg, you know, he's one of the guys that has been around this the longest in his role. And I think too, like, you just realize that you have to evolve. And I don't think I have to be Cal Dietz. You know, I'm not that smart. You know, he's the mad scientist. He gets to tinker with concepts. And yeah, I mean, maybe I could, but that just doesn't turn my crank, you know, in terms of that. I'll just listen to him and take what I think is valuable, which most of it is. I mean, all of it is. But I also think too that it's just, you know, I'm building my own cookbook, and I don't need to necessarily publish it or, you know, whatever. It's just, I'm building it through the different athletes I get exposed to, you know, and the different problems or issues that I'm trying to solve, you know. So it's not, you know, there's guys in our field that are doing that kind of work, and it's obviously very necessary, but it's, I think you also, you know, you build your own craft in whatever way, and it doesn't mean it has to fall into, you know, so many chapters in a book or whatever. And that's fine that you do that, but it's, I think that's a constant thing in our field. I think you have to be doing that kind of thing.
David, you and I talk about a lot about, like, for the young strength coach, the young and up and coming strength coach, and what's important for them to know and hear. And in a parallel, it's like, I would have never been able to make it here or been successful where I was if I didn't have the experiences I did through Springfield and into my master's degree. And that, I had 4 or 5 different philosophies. Some were amazing and some were not that great, you know, but I took something from all of them to help shape what I do now. And that's opening my mind up to a lot of different training methods. And I think the young strength coach who has that one experience and then wants that job, I don't think that's enough. Like, that's why, if you can expose and live in that situation, it's great. And you know what? You could read Cal's book. You could read Poliquin information that's out there. You can read Christian Thibodeau. You can read Cressy. You can read all these guys that are on the internet, and they're very valuable and amazing. But the coaching experience, you got to live it. You know, you can't be stuck into one philosophy or dogma or be one particular guy. You can't be a robot. But, you know,
and it's interesting too. And I still get, you know, we have a big intern program now, and, you know, we get 30, 40 kids every semester going through the gym and whatever, which is amazing. One of the goals of mine was to, you know, create a pathway for young people to get jobs. You know, I think I've hired 90, 95% of my staff from that program, you know, so it does yield results. And you get a lot of the young people coming in, and I still consider myself young, but I mean, college graduates coming in saying, oh, I want to work with pros. I'm like, yeah, me too. But if you don't go and build your coaching pedigree and your methodology, and I don't mean methodology by like sets and reps, I mean, like, how do you communicate with people? You know, if you try to teach a 12 to 14 year old how to do stuff, you better know what you're doing, you know, or you better have a reservoir of patience and a reservoir of analogies and different examples and different ways to teach it and different, like, you better be prepared. And that's a more difficult job. If I hadn't have done all the youth coaching and what have you, then, you know, when I got my first like NHL client, Adam Foote, I would have been worse than I already was, you know, and I didn't really even know what to do with him because he was so broken by the time I got him. It was, you know, he was getting ready for the 06 Olympics. That was that shirt up there. And man, I was so green. I probably didn't deserve to be working with him at the time, but he gave me a chance. And it was like, well, can't squat, you can't press, you can't do this, can't do that, because he's got all these multiple surgeries and he plays the game very hard. It's like, okay, got to find out what I can do to still yield similar results, right? And without crushing him in the process, right? So, and that was a very real thing, because if I hurt a guy like that at that time, you know, there wasn't a lot of other, you know, options that we have now in terms of rehab and, you know, even technology around surgeries and stuff like that, right? So it was like, I better find a way to make him tough and resilient and whatever. He already is those things, but how can I improve those, you know, physical capacities for him, you know, without doing the standard or the, you know, the stuff that we're all used to, you know? So it's, you have to be able to really, I'm fortunate, I think, too, because when I first started, it was a lot of young kids, right? And that's where a lot of these people start. But I think the people that get thrust into, you know, those jobs, you know, college and stuff like that, you kind of skip some of that really experiential learning that I think is so valuable. And you see people that come out of Boyle's places because, yeah, that's who they work with, right? Like, Mike, I'm sure you had similar, you know, upbringing in terms of like your coaching is like, you start with the kids that are coming in after school, yeah. You know, and you have to kind of manage that. And that's, man, that builds your skill set faster than being in a college weight room, I think, you know, because it's, I don't know, I think it's so valuable.
Explaining to a middle schooler how to squat and do a push-up is way harder than coaching college athletes.
Or how to flatten their back on like a dumbbell row.
Oh my gosh.
They have no idea what's, they don't know what's back there. No pun intended, but you know.
But it's true, right? Like I think, and yes, of course, there's a long list of successful coaches that have, you know, haven't really done that. Of course there is, there always is. But what I'm saying, I guess too, is that in my opinion, having that knowledge or the experience with those young kids, it builds your coaching. It builds your coaching acumen, right? Like how do you get a kid out of a bad mood? How do you get a really bad mover to do something good? You know, like any of those things. And because you're going to see it at the NHL level, I saw guys that couldn't throw a football. You know, you're 21 years old. You're a first round draft pick and you cannot throw a football. Why? Like that's like,
or goalies that can't catch a baseball. That's scary. Right.
Yeah, that's scary too. But there's so many of those and you can relate it back. And it's, you know, again, giving credit to Bill, it's like, teach people how to make shapes, right? Change shapes, how to move. Like, and that was kind of one of those light bulb moments for me. It's like, well, yeah, I've already done that. I just didn't realize it was like as foundational as I know it is now, you know?
How have you dealt with over their times, you know, more of a coaching question, how have you dealt with the tough situations where, you know, you've dealt with head coaches and general managers and, you know, clients, agents and parents, and sometimes, and how have you dealt with some hard situations in explaining, telling them what they don't want to hear? Right. And many times I think we had to do that, especially, you know, if you're in Anaheim and me in San Jose, it's like, especially with injuries, right? So oh, yeah. You're not getting them back, you know, from tomorrow. You may get them back next month in a way, right?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think a lot of it too is I was very fortunate in Toronto because I was working with a guy named Paul Ayotte. He was the head AT at the time. He's now with the Leafs as the head AT, and he is, in my opinion, one of the best guys. You know, and I know, Mike, you have a good relationship with your guy too. One of the best guys in the NHL, because when I first got there, and he was around my age, you know, so he was more experienced than me on the team side. I think he'd already been there for 2 years. but you know, I would sit in the treatment room at the end of the table. I'd ask questions. Is the guy getting treated? Why? You know, and he would be gracious enough to say like, oh, this is what I'm doing. This is the injury, blah, blah, blah. And then he'd follow me out into the gym and he'd, you know, roles would get switched, you know, and it was just like, well, because of what you did on the table, this is what I think we should do. And he's like, okay, cool. You know, like we would just had that cohesion right away. And we had it for a number of years. And then he got moved up and I stayed for another 2 years, I think. And when I went to Anaheim, I thought like, oh, this is, that's how it works. You know, nothing against the guy in Anaheim. He was great too, but it was just a tougher situation. Especially at the NHL level with that cohesion just becomes a lot tougher. And, you know, whereas the Marley's room, like the therapy was here, the gym was right here. You could walk in either or. Well, in Anaheim, the gym's over here. You got to walk all the way through the other side of the dressing room. The treatment room's over there, right? So that barrier right there makes it super difficult, right? Because you can't just yell through the door and say, hey, watch this. Hey, what do you think? Like that, if that gets too separated, I think that, you know, that gets difficult. And, you know, the moving on to the difficult conversations piece in Toronto, it was just, I don't know, the two teams are so polar opposites, not even funny, or two organizations, sorry. You know, just around understanding an injury or understanding performance. A lot of, you know, what we did in Anaheim was just, you know, I don't think they put enough emphasis on learning why things were happening, you know. And I know that in Toronto it was more of like, hey, let's talk about this. Why does this happen? Is there a trend? You know, they're very proactive and Anaheim was very reactive. And as you guys know, you know, it's tough to be reactive in this scenario. And I think that's where the conversations are made more difficult, because I'm always the one that's saying, you know, I can't lie, you know, and nor do I want to. So when my conversations were always tough, because I was telling the truth, like, you're not going to get this guy back sooner. Like, it's going to take X, Y, and Z. I'm going to do everything we can. He's a good worker. You know, he's doing all his he can. But at the end of the day, like, this is what it is. And like, I think you have to learn early that if you, whatever you say, and it, if it doesn't go that way, you know, people are going to remember that. But you know what I mean? Like, you kind of have to, you know, you have to be honest and you have to kind of, you know, find ways to get the most realistic result or realistic answer around those types of questions. And I think my goal was always to educate. And not that I thought I was smarter than anybody, but it was just more around like, I loved in Toronto, all the coaches worked out together, you know, so I would like program for all our coaches and like, I would be teaching them stuff and subtly throwing in stuff around, hey, this happened to someone on our team. This is what we do when this happens on the team. Hey, you hurt your back. Okay, this is why you hurt your back. And I swear, like, we did that enough. And then something would happen to one of the players. And I'd say, hey, you remember what you did to your back? Like, he did something similar. His, you know, his hips are like this. And the guy's like, oh, okay. So it's going to take him, you know, a week and a half or so. I'm like, yeah, probably. He's younger and, you know, whatever, 30 pounds lighter. So yeah, he'll be all right. But you know the process. Well, as you know, it's harder to do that at the NHL level because there's just travel and there's just stress and pressure and all that kind of stuff. And I felt like that is a miss at that level. I think, you know, at different, you know, varying degrees, you know, per team, per organization, but, you know, that integration of how those things work. And some coaches just don't want to know, right? Like, how long is he out? 6 weeks. Okay, I'll see him in 6 weeks. I think almost that's better. You know, instead of trying to understand something that they're clearly not going to understand, they just say, I'll see him in 6 weeks. Keep me updated, but I'll see him in 6 weeks. I think those guys, the cut and dry guys, are even a little bit better. The guys that kind of try to meddle in it and, well, I saw him on the ice say he looked great. Like, he looks like he can play. Like, no, he's still 2 weeks away. Like, just, you know, we're sticking to our path here. And I think that misunderstanding creates more misunderstanding, unfortunately. Because a lot of the hockey people just don't understand, you know, process of injury and or process of reconditioning and, you know, reapplication onto the field of play. You know, you could have a guy that's 8 weeks MCL and he could look fine on the ice, but you know that you can't put him in a game because if he gets hit, then he's, who knows, right? That unknown. And I think that's, you know, that's unfortunately kind of the misconceptions and the things that lead to those tough conversations around, yes, I know he looks good, but we don't want to put him in a position where if he gets hit again, the re-injury is far worse than this initial one. And I think that's, those are more of those conversations that I've had to have. And I'm sure Potsy's had them too, with just like, no, like pump the brakes. He's on path. He's doing what he needs to do. And I found that in Anaheim was just, you know, they didn't want to hear those conversations because it was, you know, either we weren't doing well or, you know, we needed this person back or whatever, right? Like it just, that misunderstanding of the process of return to play was always a tough one.
Yeah. I've had to come to learn, like, someone's 80% is better than someone else's 100, you know? Right. And it's like, okay, well, you know, I've come to learn that now. And that's with your higher end players, obviously. Right. And there's a toughness level in hockey, obviously. Not everybody has it, but they'll play through things and they'll be successful and they'll still get 2-3 points a night. And that's, which is unbelievably impressive. But at the same time, if you can get close to them, that 80%, then, and if they're safe and they can still do everything at the speeds they need to or comparable, then okay, then maybe it's the player's choice, you know. But I've always had the philosophy of overcooking the dinner, you know. There's a slide of a slide on my,
yeah,
reconditioning presentations that say dinner will be ready and when the smoke alarm goes off, you know. And yeah, that's what I tell GM, like, you know, I'd rather give you someone who's not going to be interrupted when they get back than rush this guy back and he's dog shit, you know, or yeah, again, you know. So I had my first couple combines too, and I was very, you know, college, you're working with football, you're working with all different teams as you're coming up, and I had the private experience with Mike and everything, but I was really numbers driven. So I was basing my evaluations at the NHL combine my first couple of years off of numbers. And one, our head scout who's an amazing guy, I've learned a ton from, he said, and he was very much an athletic guy, like two sport athlete in college, you know, loves just sport in general. And he said, I know what you're thinking. Like, it's not the NFL combine. He's like, you gotta give us some perspective of how long is it going to take this guy to have elite level NHL fitness? And I was like, all right, that makes complete sense to me. So now when we draft in the first round, a kid who weighs 160 and is not strong, I'm like, God, it's going to take me 3 years. So, yeah, so the conversations I've got, but we need him now. I'm like, well, you told me to give me perspective.
It's funny you say that because I had a conversation around that this past week and someone asked me about like testing and stuff like that, training camp testing. I said, you know, the goal with my testing was always around finding the best athlete. I said, because I can't tell you whether or not they can play hockey. You know, that's not my job. My job is to rate their athleticism at that point in time with tests that are proven to do so and that I believe hold weight in those areas. And, you know, I think without sounding arrogant, we always had the best athletes winning our testing, right? And all the guys that did win were always in the top three of every test. Didn't mean they won every test. They might have won maybe one or two, but they were always in the top three. And that's what you look for. And somebody who can jump, someone who can push watts on the bike, someone who can move, you know, 5-10-5, someone who can sprint. And you can pair that, like, and I don't know what it's like with what you've seen, Mike, but usually you have 10 guys that are just studs, 5 to 10 if you're lucky. 5 for sure, but 10 if you're lucky, that are just gross, off the charts. Like they just top 3 to 5 in every event, you know, crazy. And then you have from like 10 to 40 that are just within hairs of each other. You know, you have the average that's in the NHL, in my opinion, the average is doing this. Like it's getting harder and harder to be in that average group. And then you have, you know, 10 to 20, depending on how many you have in camp, that are just either really young and, you know, under developers or late bloomers, goalies, typically, not always. And, you know, you have a couple guys that maybe shouldn't be there, you know, but that's really, when you have 60 guys, that's kind of how it shakes out, you know. And like to be in that, you know, just because you're 23rd, that's still good. You know, you're not a thoroughbred, you're not in the top 5 to 10. Okay. But you're right there. You know, that's not a bad place to be. And I try to explain that to our management many times. I'm like, there's nobody here that's not fit. you know, especially from 1 to 40. Okay. Right. But you know, some of these late bloomers and people that I said, like, yeah, you're going to have to wait for them. Like, they're just not physically capable yet, but this group here, these guys are physically capable. They're all within millimeters of each other. You know, that 10 to 40, you know, those 30 to 35 guys, like, they're right there, you know? So like, and those are the guys that are going to make up your team anyways. You know what I mean? Like, those bottom kids, they're going to go back and play junior. They're going to go back, and like, there isn't a big expectation for them as long as they're, you know, showing improvement. But again, I always went to the management and said, look, I'm not telling you who can play hockey. I'm telling you who is most athletically prepared to play hockey. I'm giving you all the skill sets that they have. And, you know, our scouts loved it, because I would go and sit at the combine just like you did, and I'd sit right in front of the 5-10-5, right? Because they would do the 5-10-5, and they would come over, they'd do their chin-ups, and they'd have to take their shirts off, you know? So I would catch all those things. Sounds creepy, but I would catch all those things, because it would show me athleticism. 5-10-5, can you move? Can you move in space? Like, there's some kids, and like, nothing against them, obviously, they're not developed yet, especially at 17, 18 years old. Like, you got a bunch of those guys that are just late bloomers. They take their shirts off and they're just, you know, not really muscular. And I said, you know, I stood in front of chin-ups as well, because to me, that's puberty. That's muscular development. You know, how many can you rip off? If you can't do more than 10, well, it's not that you haven't worked at it. It's just, you don't have the same stuff going on as Buddy who did, who's just got muscle and he's got a man's body already. It's like, well, if you want a guy to play sooner, that's probably going to be your guy. But if you think that this kid is talented on the ice, well, I can work with that, you know? So my reports would always be like more of just a snapshot of like, moves well, athleticism high, you know, body mechanics and stuff very high, but just underdeveloped, you know, like, hasn't really come into his own yet. Like, so he's a slow cooker. He's going to take his full entry level before he even plays a game, you know, whereas this kid is a man already. You know, you might be able to, he'll play in the AHL next year if you want him to, you know what I mean? But that might be all he gets to compared to his talent. I have no idea, you know? So they liked my reports in that sense, because I have no idea who the kids are anyway. So like, other than, you know, the top kids or whatever that everybody knows about, but our scouts would, you know, they'd fill in the hockey piece, 'cause that's not my thing, right? That's not why I'm there.
Yeah. One of the things, like, I stole that from Kevin Neal, so kudos to him for putting up with me for 2 years as my assistant. But we looked at like the anthropometry scores from the combine, and we would just look at, you know, ankle mobility and total hip arc and that Y balance test. And there was a lot of cool stuff that you can kind of dissect for a guy skating, you know. And then I would share that with the scouts, and I would walk them through. I'm like, look, this guy's got one great hip and then one really stuck hip, you know? And they appreciated that. 'Cause I'm like, has he had any problems in the past? And they'd be like, yeah, he had a hip problem. I'm like, okay, well, you know, if you really like him, we got to clean it up, because those hips won't last. You know what I mean? We'll be changing the brake pads on this thing for a while to come. So, but to bring that into the skating side was really good, because it started more conversations with the scouts and things like that, but it made them more aware of, like, you know, yeah, this is a nice shiny car, but once you start looking under the hood, you've got to be careful, you know?
And that was a thing too, you know, you get those kids in junior that score 50 goals and whatever, and then you see them do this stuff. I'm like, yeah, they're not going to be able to survive. I don't care if he can score goals. He's got to go play against Ryan Getzlaff, who's, you know, 6'3", 215 and mean, you know, like, good luck. You're not going to withstand it. Like, it ain't going to happen. So yeah, same thing to that point. It's like, hey, like, here's what I look like when I sit in front of our scouts. I said the exact same thing as I said there. I these are the tests that I look at, and this is why I'm looking for athletic traits, high quality athletic traits. And if I don't see any, it doesn't mean that guy can't play hockey. I'm just telling you that from a physical standpoint, he may not be someone that we want to put in the lineup in the next 2 years. He's going to take time, which that's fine. Well, so they said, but really wasn't fine. So
I just want to underscore again, it sounds very obvious and logical. Yeah, only tell the coaches what you know. But I think being very clear in your communication about what it is you're saying goes a long way. And so the lesson as strength coaches is, be very intentional with with the words and the phrasing you're using to communicate to the coaching staff? Because like both of you said, long term, that'll build trust as well.
Yeah.
And
intimidating too. Like to go into a general manager and tell him what he doesn't want to hear. And especially if they're a hothead, you know, or a coach who just will blow up, and you're like, okay, I got to put my helmet on here. I got to go in and tell him I got to get this guy.
I did that a few times.
Full battle, the full blast wear on, you know, it's
tough. And I went as far, you know, David, to your point, like I outlined all our testing. I put in like a whole booklet about our testing because I changed it from what the guy previously was. And you know, he wasn't doing anything wrong. Obviously he's a legend. But what I changed is that I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to have a hand in, I didn't want to hold a stopwatch. I didn't want to count reps because I feel like that, it can sometimes strain the relationship between coach and player, and just overall, like, am I fudging things? I wanted to be completely transparent around that. So I partnered with a local university and they did it all. And I just walked around, talked to guys and whatever, but I put together, you know, the protocols and pictures and why we did what we did and how I scored things, everything, you know, put it in front of them. I don't know if any of them ever read it, but, you know, that there was a point, same thing with body fat, you know, I had to like educate them on what body fat was and how you measure it. And it's like, well, this way is better than that way. Well, no, it's not. The best way is the one that you're going to do the most consistent job of tracking. And I said, for us in season, that's pinches, because I know I'm doing it. I'm doing it every Monday, every, you know, 3 weeks or whatever. And I'm doing it every time on a Monday when we played on a Sunday. Like I was very intentional about when I did that and why. And you know, in training camp my first year, I said, like, wow, they have a DEXA machine there, they have a bod pod, and they're going to pinch as well, so we're going to use all three of those. Well, that's not very smart, because DEXA is going to be, you know, a lot higher than a pinch, just because it takes facial fat and organs and all this is crazy. But we had access to it, right? So why not? Like, if this is kind of giving us more information is better. Well, not always. And I had to explain, I don't know how many times, like, what is this DEXA scan? And I even emailed our management and said, please ignore the DEXA. It's an experiment that I'm doing with the school. I explained exactly what I just said to you about, like, how it takes in all these extra markers. Didn't matter. What is this DEXA? What is it? Why is it so high? You know, and just like,
this guy's 7% fatter than last year.
Right. Like, it's just, it was like, I should have known just from that interaction alone that I had a long road ahead of me, because it was just like, you're not listening to what I'm saying. You're not logging onto the portal and looking at the information. You're not, all you're doing is reacting to what I put in front of you. And that's, and again, I'm not saying I'm smarter or better than anybody, but it's just like, that's a lot of the time what you deal with, because these guys are under pressure too. These GMs and scouts and everybody's under that, you know, that stress to win and whatever. And when you have a good team that could do that, I think it's even worse, you know, because everybody expects, like, my first year in Anaheim, I remember getting interviewed in a local paper from back home, and like, wow, you're going to win the Stanley Cup this year. And I was like, all right, sweet. And then we lost the first 10 games in a row to start the season. So I was like, oh yeah, maybe we're not. And I kind of figured out about halfway through the year that we're definitely not, because we don't have the coach to steer our bus. But, you know, it's, that pressure is real. And, you know, you see that reactive nature come out of people because they don't see the information that they think they should see, or, you know, whatever. And that was a lot of headaches, that's for sure.
And these are NHL executives and coach. These are objectively smart humans. Imagine a regular strength coach who's talking to someone's parent, who's not only probably not as smart, but also very inherently biased in their viewpoint about that person. And I just want to emphasize, being clear in your communication is so, so important, even if it means you have to make a booklet for your coaches. I think that says a lot. Yeah. About what you did, Mark.
Over communicate, really. No. Like, that's what I know. I do segment reports every 20 games. Some strength coaches don't do it. Some, they're not required to do it, you know, but I think in the passing of our GMs out scouting, and I'm just like, okay, let me put something together. But like, so they know, because we can't have one-on-one conversations every day because they have their schedule, right? So
we do segment reports and everybody gets them. So at least they know, you know, they're not, I don't want them to be surprised. Like that's the worst, you know? Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, kind of what David was talking about, you would expect the NHL to be a high performance environment, but it's unfortunately, that's not common. You know, I would say that there's aspects of it within every organization, of course, and there's some great people that are doing some amazing things, but I think my personal opinion that hockey is still far behind of that high yeah. performance model, you know, and
yeah.
I think it's reflected in testing and just, you know, staffing per team and all these other things that in my opinion, we haven't figured it out yet. And that's not a shot at anybody. That's just in my opinion.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. Like it's only been maybe 5 years or not even 5 years, maybe three or four years that every team's had a full-time assistant strength coach.
Yeah. I didn't have one for two and a half years.
Yeah. It may be 8 years that every minor league has a head strength coach. So,
well, when I was with the Marlies, like I was, man, there was a handful of guys. Maybe yeah. because, mm-hmm. and like with Toronto, even like, I think I was making more money than some NHL head guys because it's Toronto and like, you know, whatever, right? My Belza was so good and, you know,
right.
And the manager, Brian Burke, and like, he gets it, right? Like he knows, he would fly us down to Boyle's. That's when I first met Mike mm-hmm. Boyle. He'd fly us down there every off season, just go hang out for a few days, nice. Be a fly on the wall. I'm like, all right, awesome. Like this is at the time he was in his old location. It was like, wow, they're going to pay me to go and hang out with, you know, Boyle for a couple of days. Like, yeah, I'll take that. You know, like it's, yeah, it was just a different way to look at it for sure.
Well, Mark, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Do you have any last thoughts? Ask of the audience places where people can find you and reach out and say hello.
Well, yeah, all the regular social channels at Fitzgerald ETS. I wouldn't say I'm overly good at getting back to people, but I do my best. And then, yeah, I'm hoping to help out more with the SCAF initiative and kind of contribute where I can. I know there's some things in the works between Mike and I that we've been speaking about that'll hopefully come to fruition here in 21 and, you know, happy to support it and be a part of it. And it's a great group, a great initiative. So I'm excited for the future.
All right. Well, thank you so much once again. And we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Fitzy.
Yeah. Good thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you everybody so much for listening. And once again, thank you Mike and Mark for joining me on this episode. You can find links to everything discussed, including where to find Mark on his website, social media, all of those channels at the official website of SCAF, prohockeystrength.com.